So the year's 1901, a letter to Professor Wilhelm Ostwald, University of Leipzig, Germany. Esteemed Herr Professor, please forgive a father who is so bold as to turn to you, esteemed Herr Professor, in the interest of his son. I shall start by telling you that my son is 22 years old, that he feels profoundly unhappy with his present lack of position and his idea that he has gone off the tracks with his career and now is out of touch, gets more and more entrenched each day. In addition, he is oppressed by the thought that he is a burden on us, people of modest means. I've taken the liberty of turning to you with the humble request to write him, if possible, a few words of encouragement so that he might recover his joy in living and in working. If, in addition, you could secure him an assistance position for now or next autumn, my gratitude would know no bounds. I'm also taking the liberty of mentioning that my son does not know anything about my unusual step. I remain, highly esteemed Herr Professor, your devoted Hermann Einstein. Herr Professor Ostwald never responded. And although that didn't succeed, it was Einstein's father who helped him secure a position in the patent office, the famous patent office. His university grades were not all that exceptional. In fact, he was barely average. But that wasn't the biggest problem. The biggest problem was for him to get a job. Even while he was going to school, he needed references, and his teachers were giving him references like the following. They were furious at his telling jokes and cutting classes. Over the years, they were irritated by his lack of obedience, most notably his high school Greek grammar teacher, Joseph Dagenhart, who reached immortality by saying the following, "Nothing would ever become of you." Later, when he said it would be the best if you left school, he explained that your presence in the class destroys the respect of the students. Outwardly, Einstein still appeared confident. The year before, 1904, he had applied for promotion from patent office third class to second class clerk. He'd been rejected because his boss thought he was fooling around too much, that he wasn't his work. He had displayed some good achievement, but he had to wait until he could become more familiar with mechanical engineering before they would promote him to patent office clerk level two. Now, the lack of success was becoming a problem for him. He and his wife had to give away their first child because they couldn't afford to raise. It was a daughter born before they were married. And they're now trying to raise the second child on a patents clerk salary. He was 26. He couldn't afford the money for part-time help to let his wife go back to work or back to her studies. He was falling behind in the university because he had to work at the patent office. He got out of the patent office, and the library at Bern, Switzerland, was closed. So he couldn't keep up on the latest in physics, which was always had been his love. And if he tried to do any work, he had his boss at the patent office always looking over his shoulder, making sure he wasn't doing anything that was not specific to his job. And then on what Einstein later remembers as a beautiful day in the spring of 1905, he met his best friend, Michael Besso, for one of their long strolls outside the city. Often they would gossip, talk about the gossip of life in the patent office. He loved music, he talked about music, but on this particular day, Einstein was uneasy. In the past few months, a great deal of what he'd been thinking about had started to come together. But there was still something Einstein felt he was near to understanding but could not yet quite see. That night, Einstein still couldn't grasp it, but the next day he suddenly woke up feeling the greatest excitement, his words. "It just took 5 or 6 weeks to write up the first draft of the article, filling 30-some pages. It was the start of his theory of relativity." He sent the article to a publisher to be published. About a few weeks later, he realized he'd left something out. A 3-page supplement was soon delivered to the same physics journal. He admitted to another friend that he was a little unsure how accurate the supplement was. Quote, "The idea is assuming and enticing, but whether the Lord is laughing at it and has played a trick on me, that I cannot know," close quote. But in the text itself, he began confidently, quote, "The results of an electrodynamic investigation recently published by me in this journal lead to a very interesting conclusion, which will be derived here," close quote. And then four paragraphs from the end of his supplement, he wrote it out. And hence, the world's most famous equation was born, and it came out of special relativity. Special relativity simplified, and my subject is not special relativity because, ironically, I am inept, frankly, when it comes to things that I'm talking about today. Math and science, that's not my thing. I'm interested, but I'm clueless. But I have a desire to learn, and I figure that's enough. And we can start learning and getting into this. But I read about this equation many years ago, and it completely changed. I could tell you what it meant, but I didn't know what it meant, if you know what I mean. It was limiting. Yeah, I can tell you what those things mean, but what does it really mean? What's the impact of that equation? And it is the world's most famous equation. So Albert Einstein was born 1879 in Germany. He died in Princeton, New Jersey in 1955. The Einsteins were non-observant Ashkenazi Jews. That's Eastern Europe Jews. He married in 1903 to Mileva Marek. They divorced in 1919. He remarried Elsa Lowenthal in 1919, and they remained married until her death in 1936. So he remained a bachelor from 1936 to 1955 when he died. Survived by three children. He was visiting the U.S. in 1933. That was the year that Hitler came to power in Germany. Once he discovered that Hitler had come to power, he said, "I'm not going back," and so he never returned to Germany. He stayed in the U.S. and became a U.S. citizen in 1940. PhD in physics, University of Zurich. He became a professor there before coming to the U.S. Became the world's most famous physicist after his theories of special and then general relativity. Those came in that order. Then he did the photoelectric effect, which was an important step in the world of quantum mechanics, for which he received his one and only Nobel Peace Prize, 1921, I believe. Gravitational waves, his discovery of gravitational waves, and of course the cosmological constant. But it's the gravitational waves that became very relevant today, and that is, last month, two neutron stars had collided, of course, eons in the past, and the light from those stars was just reaching us. And when it was discovered that this had happened, all the telescopes that were available on the Earth were aimed at that point in space to see the light and detect directly, for the first time, gravitational waves. And the physicists were beside themselves. And so there's a lot on the internet, and this just happened last month. So it's a big deal. And they're all saying, you know, this is fabulous. It verifies what theory told us, what Einstein told us about gravitational waves. We've been able to verify it directly, not just indirectly, which they had done a couple of years before, but directly. You get two neutron stars colliding. Apparently, a neutron star is not very big, maybe 20, 30 miles across, but it's incredibly dense. A teaspoon full of matter would weigh billions of tons. That's dense. What's going on out there in the world of astronomy and the world of space is unreal. Hubble has brought us much of what's out there. In fact, 60 Minutes did a piece on, it's called VAST, a couple of months ago, that was just incredible on the Hubble. But I digress. Also in the news, you may have seen this, Einstein's notes he gave as a tip, sold at auction for $1 million. He was in Japan, and he was in a hotel, and he had just learned he'd won the Nobel Peace Prize, 1922-ish, I think. Yeah, 1922. And a delivery person arrived, and they either would not accept tips because of culture or whatever, but instead of giving him a tip, he scribbled a note. In fact, there were two notes. The first note said this: "A calm and modest life brings more happiness than the pursuit of success combined with constant restlessness." And then the second one was, you've heard this one, Where There's a Will, There's a Way. That one sold for $240,000, and the other one, $1.5 million. Something else, huh? It was a tip. And whoever ended up with those, and they did it in German, of course, but it was just scribbled on the back of the hotel stationery. He signed it, and that's what made it valuable. Okay, this. So up until Einstein, the sense had been that there were lots of energy sources, chemical energy, magnetic, heat, and so forth. Those were the teachings of the day, and the teachings of the day were that energy and mass were completely separate concepts, that never the twain shall meet. They had nothing whatsoever to do with each other. Energy was measured in horsepower and kilowatt hours and so forth, whereas mass was measured in pounds and kilos and tons. And nobody thought that you should connect the two, or you could connect the two, that they were completely different. And the world has struggled with connecting things that are different. Is there a relationship? And if there is, how can we use that relationship? How can we connect the two things? And I'll give you an example. Inches and centimeters. Well, before I get to inches and centimeters, Fahrenheit and centigrade evolves differently, and there's a conversion factor. And the conversion factor is, to go from centigrade to Fahrenheit, you have to multiply centigrade by 9/5 and then add 32. Inches to centimeters. Inches developed in medieval England. It's the width of your thumb. I checked it out last night. It's not at the tip of your thumb, but for me, right there where the knuckle is, and I put up a ruler, and it's exactly 1 inch. So you always had your ruler with you as long as you had thumbs. Right? And maybe that's an issue in medieval England, but as long as you had thumbs, you had it. You know where centimeters come from? The most bizarre thing, French Revolution, and you got to leave it to the French for this one. This one blew me away. So centimeters is the distance, 1/1,000,000,000th of the distance between the equator and the North Pole passing by Paris. Who in their right mind comes up with such a thing? Well, apparently the French. So there's a conversion factor, which is 0.3937. You multiply centimeters by 0.3937, you get to inches. The practical English and the impractical French, or the philosophical French, or whatever. But there's an example of something that evolved completely differently, and you're trying to connect the two. And the thought was, energy and mass have nothing to do with each other. So don't even bother looking there. Well, special relativity comes along in 1905. He publishes his paper, and it's the footnote, effectively. It's the supplement. It's the bottom of the supplement where he lays out this equation. He said, something interesting, he says. Something interesting comes out of my work in relativity, and that's that. Okay, so what is that? Speed of light. You got energy. So this is your energy, right? This is mass. This is the speed of light. Squared. Now, you didn't need to be a mathematician to figure out that's a big number. How big? Speed of light. So I don't make a mistake. Speed of light, measured in miles per hour, $670 million miles per hour. Square that. Multiply it by itself. stare at that number for a second. Isaac Newton had given us his laws of motion. The issue is, why square this? How do you come up with this? And what you realize when you read what Einstein's writing is that so much for him is inspiration and imagination. It's creativity. It's not deriving something by laborious work, working through the math. He would claim that he was not a very good mathematician. Great physicist, not a really good mathematician. But he would derive these things. Like you said, I woke up one morning and it hit me. And he's scribbling as fast as he can to get it all on paper, all 30 pages plus the supplement. And he just thought, he said, I'm not smarter than anybody else, he claimed, but I just stick with the problem longer. I stay with it. I don't let it go. It ruminates. Well, the laws of motion. You probably are familiar with this one, mv2 squared. So mass equals, let's see, what did I say? mv2? Yeah. You multiply an object's mass by the square of its velocity. So, mv2. This was known by physicists at the time, so it wasn't a huge leap to use the same concept in squaring the speed of light. If the velocity of a ball was 100 miles an hour, then they knew that the energy it carried would be proportional to its mass times 100 squared. If the velocity is raised as high as it could go to 670 million the miles per hour, the speed of light, it's almost as if the ultimate energy an object will contain should be revealed when you look at its mass times c squared, or mc squared. The equal sign in this equation is, you could view it as a tunnel or a bridge. When you cross over, something happens. When you cross from energy to mass, or this direction, there is an amplification here, and the amplification is that. It amplifies anything on that side of the equation, becomes a massive number. Means that mass is simply the ultimate type of condensed or concentrated energy. Energy is the reverse. It is what billows out as an alternate form of mass under the right circumstances. Converting wood to smoke and ash is a chemical burn. There is, however, within that mass, that wood, a much greater energy source than simply burning it in a bonfire. There's an expansion that occurs when you get to the nuclear atomic level, and the expansion is because of that equation, the c squared portion. It's a magnification of mass. And how does this work? Under the proper circumstances, any substance can be exploded outward as energy. That's in the power that is around us, that is encased in all objects that we see. Plants, animals, streams, rocks. The linkage is omnipresent in our ordinary world. This tremendous energy source is, it's almost in abeyance, it's quivering, it's inside of all matter. But how much energy? I have some trail mix here, in case I got hungry. So any trail mix worth its salt, so to speak, has a raisin. Here's a raisin. Used to be a grape. Now it's a raisin. Not very big. The nuclear energy, if you could convert this, nuclear, not chemical, but nuclear, convert this to energy, pure energy, you'd have enough power to run New York City for a day. Think about that. All the electricity that New York City consumes in a day is in here. And this is a raisin. This is not Mount Everest. Imagine the power in Mount Everest. It's in all matter, all physical matter. That equation says you have an explosion of energy if you could somehow figure out a way to convert this to that kind of energy. We don't have the technology to do it, or at least we didn't in 1905. Nobody knew how to access this. The physicists around Europe and everywhere, they looked at this equation, they said, yep, we agree with that. But so what? What's it going to do for us? How do we access it? How do we access the atom? Well, Einstein had nothing to say about that. This is where the equation and Einstein stop. And it's for somebody else to pick up and figure out what's next. Now, who was that somebody else? Thanks to the work of a female Austrian physicist, Lisa Meitner. And there's a whole story about how this happens. She's out walking with her nephew in the snow. And it's outdoors, and something occurs to her, and they sit down and they start scribbling by a tree. And how that comes about is again, a story in its own right. She determines that nuclei are not all created equal. How do you access, how do you get into the into the inner workings? The idea is you take this, you say, okay, I've got to get into the micro of matter. I've got to get right down to the essential pieces. So they look at the nucleus, and they look at the nuclear forces, the strong force, the weak force, and all of that inside of a nucleus, and they realize these things, you cannot penetrate. You cannot unlock, because most matter is stable. There is some matter, however, that's not stable, and the reason it's not stable is because the nucleus is large. The larger the nucleus, the more unstable, and one of the biggest of all nuclei is uranium. So the idea is to pound neutrons to try to get, and Niels Bohr had come up with the idea that the nucleus is not like a ball bearing. It's not hardened. It's more like a droplet of water. And if you can insert into that droplet of water enough matter, you can burst it. That was the concept. So they're trying to figure out, okay, we're gonna slam this with neutrons and see what happens. And they figured out that a uranium nucleus is susceptible. It starts to wobble, it quivers, and then it bursts. You're dividing effectively the atom, which we've later come to know as nuclear fission. Well, that was the idea. Once you do that and you have this explosion and you are able to measure what's happened, these bits that are flying apart weigh less than before. And the energy that's coming out that's causing it to do that, it crossed over. It went from mass to energy. That, of course, has ominous implications. That tiny little mass that powered that velocity and that escape. The same principle effectively is operating in the sun. The sun operates by taking four hydrogen atoms. So if you took your four hydrogen atoms and you just said, let's just go like this, 1 + 1 + 1 + 1 = 4. When they are under tremendous pressure and they are fused together, you get helium. But then when you measure this atomic weight, you don't get 4 once you have helium. What you get, I get the number precise, is 3.993, which means 0.7% is lost. It's lost as energy. That's how the sun operates. Now, this is an ominous finding. In theory, you could start cracking open nuclei and finding a tremendous energy source. The timing of Lisa Meitner's discovery, 1938. Einstein learned about it. He then wrote a letter. He was encouraged by various people to write a letter to Roosevelt. This is what he said. "Sir, some recent work, Lisa Meitner, which has been communicated to me in manuscript, leads me to expect that the element uranium may be turned into a new and important source of energy in the immediate future. Certain aspects of the situation which has arisen seem to call for watchfulness and, if necessary, quick action on the part of the administration. This new phenomenon would lead to the construction of bombs, and it is conceivable, though much less certain, that extremely powerful bombs of a new type may thus be constructed. A single bomb of this type, carried by a boat and exploded in a port, might well destroy the whole port, together with some of the surrounding territory. Yours very truly, Albert Einstein." The White House. "My dear Professor, I want to thank you for your recent letter and the most interesting and important enclosure. I found this data of such import that I have convened a board. Please accept my sincere thanks. Very sincerely yours, Franklin Roosevelt." In accordance with Washington bureaucracy, nothing happened. Effectively, those in charge let this sit, and it sat, and it sat. Not going anywhere. ...1939 was the date of the letter. It was effectively buried. But the Germans were not slow on the uptake. The Germans appreciated immediately what they had here. Once you had the equation and you had the way to access the atom, it's all you needed. Joseph Goebbels, Hitler's propaganda minister, wrote this in his diary. "I received a report about the latest development in German science. Research in the realm of atomic destruction has now proceeded to a point where tremendous destruction, it is claimed, can be wrought with a minimum of effort. It is essential that we be ahead of everybody." And so who is their German scientist? You know, I always talked about the Russian and the nuclear arms race, the U.S. using its German scientists and the Soviet Union using its German scientists. Who is the German scientist in Germany tasked with this issue specifically? It was Werner Heisenberg, famous for the Heisenberg uncertainty principle in quantum mechanics. And he was enlisted, that was the guy for the job, and he was enlisted to develop a bomb. Einstein, because nothing was happening in the U.S., he later meets personally with President. And it's believed that these efforts ultimately resulted, finally, in what became known as the Manhattan Project, which was the U.S.'s attempt to develop the bomb before the Germans. For Einstein, war was a disease. He was a pacifist. He says that he only did what he did for fear that Germany would get the bomb first. Nobody, of course, could be confident that the U.S. would win the race. In fact, all the odds would be against the U.S. winning this race. At the time of the outbreak of World War II, U.S. had and could supply about two divisions. Much of the supply was World War I artifacts for a World War II army. It ranked about number 10 in the world, right about the level of Belgium. Imagine that. When the U.S. enters the war, that it's a tribute to the U.S., to the U.S.'s, to our people, to the citizenry, to ramp up as quickly as the U.S. did. We were not prepared for Pearl Harbor. You read some of the stories about the planes that our air people had to fly that were barely serviceable. That's where we were. It didn't look promising. When you have this on the table and you know the Germans are moving ahead, you got to double your efforts on this side, and then you got to figure out we got to sabotage the Germans. That was left for the English, to sabotage the Germans. Heisenberg was using heavy water. Deuterium, I think that's the name. It's the water that we drink, most of it is H2O, but not all of it. So in a typical swimming pool, good-sized swimming pool, you might have a glass of water that's not H2O. It's a different element. It doesn't hurt you. You don't even notice it. But it's heavier weight, heavier atomic weight. And there are reasons, physics reasons, why heavy water was big for the Germans, and they didn't have a plant, but the Norwegians did. And there was a movie made about this. I remember as a kid, I said, what the heck is heavy water? But it was an attempt to sabotage the German effort at developing that heavy water. And they did it, and they did it multiple times. And the first English attempt didn't work, and so the resistance, the Norwegian resistance, ultimately managed to pull it off more than once to keep the Germans at bay while the Americans could catch up, or anybody else for that matter. And that race for the bomb, which is really something. I mean, Einstein says, I never would have lifted a finger to help if I knew that Germany would not have the bomb before they surrendered. I never would have opened this thing up. I never would have pressed, because again, he's a pacifist. He was so fearful that Hitler would, with this technology, rule the world, that he made the push to America, you've got to do this first. And ultimately, it results in the Manhattan Project. Now, he's not involved in the Manhattan Project, but he's one of the ones that's credited with getting it moving in this country. Now, the bombs dropped on Japan were the result of sucking a few ounces of uranium out of existence. That's it. Remember I told you about the raisin? Well, if you turn peaceful use to non-peaceful use, you get two bombs over Japan. A few ounces converted into energy using that equation destroyed Nagasaki, Hiroshima. It was 1954. It was the year before his death. And I'll give you the quote. He told one of his old friends, Linus Pauling, a household name, I made one great mistake in my life when I signed the letter to President Roosevelt recommending that the atom bombs be made. But there was some justification, he says, the danger that the Germans would make them. Then he told his longtime secretary, this is the quote I mentioned earlier, had I known that the Germans would not succeed in producing an atomic bomb, I would never have lifted a finger, not a single finger, to help. Because he knew, of course. Now the sun pumps 4 million tons of hydrogen, converts it into energy every second. So think about that. 4 million tons of hydrogen every second is converted. The earth has been nurtured and warmed, and we have been blessed for, what, billions of years now, ever since this planet's been in existence, by that great furnace in the sky that uses effectively that equation to convert mass to energy. And it keeps us alive. Now, one of the things that I learned about Einstein. In fact, when you look at all of this and you realize there are all kinds of metaphors you can draw from this, you know. If all matter contains within it so much energy, then you look at the Big Bang and you think, well, what was that? What was that singularity? What was that point? Was it all mass or was it energy? And it was energy. Tremendous amount of energy that's converted to mass with the Big Bang. Ultimately, all the planets, all the stars, all of that come out of this explosion of such an enormous amount of energy, this point that the physicists talk about. And all of the heavy elements, they talk, and these neutron stars, by the way, that collided, the heavy elements that can only be created in certain circumstances, like lead, gold, all of the elements ultimately are created out of energy. These are, as the equation says, you can go back and forth. It's just that equal sign. When you cross over one way or the other, there are big things that happen because of that. Now, Einstein had a lot to say about a lot of subjects. And when you read about him and you read about his work and him as a person, and you try to figure him out, you try to figure out who is he, how does this guy operate? And of course, against the family's wishes, they preserved his brain. Family didn't know about it. They when he died, they took his brain. They tried to figure out what was it about his brain that was so different than the rest of us. And I don't know that anybody ever figured that out, but the family was not happy about it because they were not apprised of it, did not give their consent. But when you read about him and you read about what he thought was important, and I'm going to give you some quotes about, for him, what mattered, and you realize, wow, this is not the Einstein that I was imagining. I was imagining someone that was so focused on one thing that everything else was just, he had no interest in anything else. It turns out that he had great interest in music. He was a musician himself. He loved music, classical music, of course. But here's some quotes to live by from Albert Einstein. If you can't explain it to a six-year-old, you don't understand it. There's a lot of truth to that. If you want your children to be intelligent, read them fairy tales. If you want them to be more intelligent, read them more fairy tales. He was about imagination. A different sort than I was expecting. I was expecting it to be plotting. You go from one concept and one theory to the next, and then ultimately you derive this. That's not how he worked. Logic will get you from A to Z. Imagination will get you everywhere. When you are courting a nice girl, an hour seems like a second. When you sit on a red-hot cinder, a second seems like an hour. That's relativity. Yeah, that's right. A clever person solves a problem. A wise person avoids it. Science without religion is lame. Religion without science is blind. So he sees there's a connection between the two, an obvious connection. If we knew what it was we were doing, it would not be called research, would it? I have no special talents. I am only passionately curious. It's not, I referred to this one before, it's not that I'm so smart, but I stay with the questions much longer. Here's one, the best way to cheer yourself is to cheer somebody else. There's a lot of wisdom here. It's not just physics. This is a deep man. Learning things over a lifetime. It would be possible to describe everything scientifically, but it would make no sense. It would be without meaning. As if you described a Beethoven symphony as a variation of wave pressure. I never made one of my discoveries through the process of rational thinking. Isn't that something? That's the point about imagination. He harps on this over and over again, how valuable that is. And of course, he was not a great student. That's why his professors would say, he's not, nothing going to come of him. Because he didn't do things the way the textbook said you should do things. When you have genius, genius goes past all of that. That's not where genius is. Genius is in imagination. It's in thinking deeper and deep thoughts. Not rote, not piece by piece, not this rational progress from one point to another. This is my favorite. We all know that light travels faster than sound. That's why certain people appear bright until you hear them speak. And here's another one. Nothing happens until something moves. Things to act and things to be acted upon. Nothing happens until something moves. A ship is always safe at the shore, but that is not what it is built for. Only a life lived for others is a life worthwhile. Einstein. Philosophy from Einstein. Philosophy for a living. Imagination is the highest form of research. God does not play dice with the universe. You can never solve a problem on the level on which it was created. Think about that one. I mean, this stuff, you give talks on these. You can't solve a problem on the level that it was created. Student, Dr. Einstein, aren't these the same questions as last year's physics final exam? Einstein, yes, but this year the answers are different. Oh, man. And the final one. Someone asked him about God and the creation. He said, "Your question is the most difficult in the world. It is not a question I can answer simply with yes or no. I am not an atheist. I do not know if I can define myself as a pantheist. The problem involved is too vast for our limited minds. May I not reply with a parable? The human mind, no matter how highly trained, cannot grasp the universe. We are in the position of a little child entering a huge library whose walls are covered to the ceiling with books in many different tongues. The child knows that someone must have written those books. It does not know who or how. It does not understand the languages in which they are written. The child notes a definite plan in the arrangement of the books, a mysterious order which it does not comprehend, but only dimly suspects. That, it seems to me, is the attitude of the human mind, even the greatest and most cultured toward God. We see a universe marvelously arranged, obeying certain laws, but we understand the laws only dimly. Our limited minds cannot grasp the mysterious force that sways the constellations." Our time is up, but let me just finish by saying this. I have always felt like learning is it's almost like breathing. What would life be like if we didn't seek for knowledge in all areas? Education, inquiry, our own desire to improve our minds and think deep thoughts in the time that we have between our jobs and other kinds of things. And it's hard to take time to do this, but when you do, you are rewarded. Even if you only scratch the surface. I can only scratch the surface in physics. I appreciate those who have the brains to go deep. Our astrophysicists and people who can tell us things about the Earth and about space. So feeding not just your brain, but your soul. This is soul food. It's not just brain food. This is enlightening. This is ennobling. And there's so many people who have lived that have contributed so mightily to our understanding, and Einstein is one of them. There's a book by Charles Murray called Human Accomplishment, and it identifies those people in the world, in history of the world, who have made contributions in math, physics, chemistry, the arts, music, anything, to humanity and to our culture, to our civilization. And of course, there's a whole methodology for doing this, and Charles Murray is a sociologist at Harvard, or was at Harvard, famous for the bell curve, or infamous for the bell curve. And under physicists, he ranks them, you know, 100 down to 1 in terms of contributions. And if you make the list, you're a significant contributor, even if you're number 1. But if you're 100, you are without peer. And there are 2 physicists at 100. They're so close, I couldn't rank them 1 and 2. Sir Isaac Newton and Albert Einstein. Once in a generation, once in a century, once in a millennium, they don't come along very often. That they see things we don't see. They have insight we don't see. And their insight, many years after their death, is confirmed. These physicists who jump up and down and say, Einstein was right. We now have definite proof, not just indirect proof, but definite proof that he was right. Gravitational waves, we've observed them various ways, and now we see actually what's going on, and we see gravitational waves because you see 2 neutron stars colliding. It's a galactic wonder. And you check the box. Yep, that creativity, that imaginer was right. That brain got it right. And we are all the recipients, for good or for bad, how we use this. This lights the Eiffel Tower, by the way. France, 80% of its energy comes from nuclear energy. Exit signs. They're little. This equation is used in exit signs and in a lot of the smoke detectors. They don't want to rely on batteries and they don't want to rely on electricity, so they rely on that equation. Little nuclear reactions going on. You slow down the reaction and you can create power for France. So the Eiffel Tower is lit at night thanks to that equation, as is most of France. There are great many peaceful uses of this. But like anything else, it can be used to destroy. A hammer builds this place. A hammer, when applied to my skull, not so much. It can destroy. Same instrument, how it's used makes all the difference. And that's true of physical things, and it's true of moral things. The internet can be used for great things and can be used for great debauchery. It's the way it is. It's the wheat and the tares. It's good and bad. It's good and evil. It's the way everything is. There's opposition everywhere in anything. Anything done to excess can be turned into an evil. I'm not sure if you can have excessive virtue. Maybe you can, maybe you can't. I don't know. But most things, chocolate is a great thing. When used to excess, it becomes a bad thing. Right? And that's true of everything. And that's true of this. Peaceful uses and incredibly destructive uses. The same equation, the same principle, used in different hands. And that's what Einstein bequeathed to us, for good or bad. It's how we use the tools we've been given. He's impressive. If you want to learn more about this equation and the history of the equation, this is a book I read many years ago, The Biography of the Equation. It's fabulous. It's well-written, and it's easy to understand for us non-mathematical, non-physics-type people.